We get things underway in the second hour, though, by welcoming back to the program our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Kimball?
I'm doing well, thank you. You are already a man on a mission. You've been pretty busy just 3 days into the new year.
I like to set the tone. Tone begins the morning of that first day. And I didn't run stairs that first day, so you might be disappointed in me. But I did 1,000 push-ups on that first day, tying my personal best. So good start to the year with that. Wrote a couple stories, back to running stairs, 5,000 yesterday, 3,000 today. Lonely stairs in Boston in the rain, in the January rain. Not many people out there with me.
And you're doing those push-ups like out on the sidewalk and the roads, right?
Yeah, I do them. It probably looks pretty ostentatious to people when they see me around. But if you're going to do 1,000 push-ups, I do those in mostly in sets of 20, some 30. And then sometimes, because you're doing them so close together, it'll be 10. And, I don't know, 5 or 6 times near the end, actually, my arms will give out. But if you're doing 1,000 push-ups, you're on the move and you're dropping and you're doing them in some pretty weird places. You're just, that's the nature of the beast, unless you want it to take 9 hours. And I tried to get it done because I don't want to be doing push-ups all day. I try to get it done in about 3 hours, but you'll see me on the ground in all kinds of places. I don't do it inside of stores, but anywhere outside, it's really 25 different spots.
And you've been, was it about 6 months maybe that you've been doing push-ups?
I think I started them, I don't know, March or April and last year. And so when I first started them, I could do a set of 15. And that was it. I hadn't done them in a lot of years. Now, if I go a few days without doing them, I can do, the most I've done is a set of 50. But today I did 100. So the way I'll do it is I step outside into the hallway because there's no room in here, believe it or not, to actually even do push-ups, and I do 30, and then I go downstairs a couple flights, and I shake my arms out as I'm going down, and I do 20, and then I head out to the stairs, and it's a 5-minute walk, and on the way, I stop and do 20, and I'm up to 70, and I run the stairs, and on the way back, I do a set of 30, so it's pretty easy to get up to 100, but it's like anything. If you do it, and that can be painting, it can be writing, it can be shooting 3-pointers, if you do it a lot, you just get, I'm not Charles Atlas or anything, but you get better at it where people think it's impressive, even though it's not.
Well, it's all relative out there, but that's the kind of thing that there are a whole lot of people that could not do any and wouldn't even attempt to do any, but to go out there and bang out 100 along with the stairs and everything else, I am impressed with that. But then again, you are a Zulu warrior, so it's in keeping with the profile.
It's a mental discipline thing. Someone said to me, and I just found it surprising, and then I was surprised that I found it surprising, because it's really not, that they made some remark about going out and running the stairs every day. And lately I've been thinking about it as I do that, because I do it for a larger purpose, so I can endure certain things that I have to endure. When you're out there on January 3rd and it's raining and slick and it's just kind of miserable, I think to myself now, really have to believe in something to be doing this. So it's larger than just the act, the physical act. And if you do 100, something like 100 push-ups, which I feel like anyone can get up to that in some time, it's like an achievement. I mean, the first day of the year, you do 1,000 of them, and it's like people have this post-holiday blues. I have blues all the time anyway, but I have to motivate myself that way and find these pockets of achievement so I can hang in there and do these other things. But a lot of it is the mental discipline. It's an attitude. I mean, that's really what the whole Zulu ethos is, Kimball, as you know.
Well, and with that, is there even more satisfaction when you go out there and do the stairs and then do the push-ups and everything on a day when it's cold and wet and brutal? Do you feel even better about that after you finish?
Yeah, to be honest with you, doing the stairs today was actually easier, because you have, it's like a field trip. You get a little bonus boost with it, because you would still think it was the holidays. There's no one out in Boston today. And part of that is just people seem to work at home now, but this is right at City Hall. So you're a city employee, and there weren't people coming in and out of that building. Like, they had begged off work or got in early and weren't coming out to get a Starbucks or lunch or whatnot. And yeah, so it actually, ironically, paradoxical that you get like a little more of a boost, because it wasn't, I don't know what's like up there, but it was raining, and you feel good, and you breathe that into your lungs, and you pop up off the dirt from doing the push-ups, and you let out like a little Zulu yelp, and you just think, these MFers, there's no way, I'm the beast, Kimball. Oh, I'm getting pumped, I want to do it again now.
Well, can you hang on for 25 minutes?
Yeah.
Hold off as best you can. We got things to talk about. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown this afternoon. Let's talk about a couple of radio productions. First, another one with Frank Lovejoy on The Night Beat. Interesting episode called I Wish You Were Dead.
This is so good. This is one of the best episodes of Night Beat. I feel pretty certain about that. What I like about this is it's a horror story. It's a ghost story in a way, but it also could just be coincidence, right? We talked about that story, August Heat, where the guy's out taking a walk and he comes across someone who chisels up headstones, and the guy has his name, he's chiseled into the headstone, and like, he has the guy's birthday. Could be a coincidence. It might not be a coincidence. They decide to wait it out. So in this story, our man of the Night Beat is out before he goes to work. So he goes to work at night. He walks around Chicago, and he finds a human interest story. So it's before that. And there's this guy on a bench, and he overhears the guy say, he thinks he's saying it about him, I wish you were dead. And what the guy is really doing is he's killing a pigeon. He believes that by saying, I wish you were dead, he will kill whatever or whomever he's wishing that death upon. And lo and behold, there's a dead pigeon.
Yeah, and it's his, it's his certainty that is most disconcerting.
His tragic, crestfallen, defeated certainty. And so this is going to continue on. So our man sits down with him on the bench, and I love the plain speak. I find that the best radio, for it to work as well as it can work, you need this sort of everyday plain speak. Mm. And a lot of that is going to be in the believability of the reaction. And a lot of the people who are best at this, they have sort of these go-to words they use, even if it's just the word yeah, but they imbue it with a kind of tonal shading. Think of William Conrad on Gunsmoke, the way he uses a yeah. Because a lot of times we end up saying yeah in conversation, but it's on the radio. So it has to be interesting. It can't just be you talking to your buddy on the phone where you don't really think he's listening to you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's not going to work. That passive yeah, you need maybe not an active yeah, but you need a yeah with some timbre to it. So he takes this guy seriously. He's going to hear him out. He's a very good listener. And we get a human death. It's like a guy washing windows. And so our reporter guy, he goes off and he sort of looks into this because he wants it to be explained away, coincidence. And the story has this, I mean, the ending is pretty gutting. And we find out that this person who's able to, or believes he's able to command this power, dies himself, and we get these words overheard by his landlady, and really just kind of the perfect ending to this spooky, disturbing story.
Yeah, and you're so right about the conversation, too. I always say in acting, some of the best acting is reacting, listening. And if you're watching a movie or a television show, you can see through facial expressions. But boy, when it's a radio serial, you've got to rely on those brief little interjections, the yas or whatever it might be, and make that sound conversational and sound like your protagonist is actually listening to the other person. And it's done so well in this, and it reminded me of the best of the Johnny Dollar episodes in that way.
Listening is a form of absorption. It's like the way a canvas absorbs paint, and that paint shows on the canvas. the way someone listens, whether it's on radio, TV, in real life, is a form of absorption that shows. A lot of, I've said before, like, for instance, The World, kind of in a way, what the nonfiction version, what this particular series is about. The World wants to give you stories. And that doesn't mean you're transposing the literal, but the way you experience the world and the way you listen to the world, and maybe it jars some other thought free in your head that has been hanging around for 17 years, untapped, just like something hanging in a cave, and down it comes into your conscious mind. The world has given you that. And this character, and Johnny Dollar is another, and Marshall Dillon is another, they listen in this fashion. And they all have similar jobs in a way. They're really what they are, even though they have three different job titles, they're investigators. Marshall Dillon's like an investigator. That's what he is on Sure He's the Sheriff. And Johnny Dollar is technically an investigator, and this character is also an investigator. I would say that we should be tasked to listen as investigators as we go about the world around us. So this is just a conversation on the bench, and people are plot. That's going to launch the entire story. I feel like a lot of the stuff, the action, once the action starts, you usually know how it's going to work out. I want to get through that and hang on what people have to say to each other, how one talks, how the other absorbs.
Let's move on to another radio broadcast that is, I'm going to say, the top three strangest broadcasts you've had me give a listen to. It's a Wonderful Life. We know the story so well. Jimmy Stewart is there. Frank Capra is even there. And then an unexpected guest in this broadcast.
Yeah, this is for, like, you late at night after you've listened to Sergeant Pepper and Piper at the Gates of Dawn and dabbled in hallucinogenics. And because we had introduced people, probably, maybe some of them knew it, to the to another radio version of It's a Wonderful Life from just a few months after the film had come out. This is a couple years after that, and no one knows this one at all. And James Stewart is back, and he is paired with Clarence, who is, well, he's Elmer Fudd. He's actually, not only is he the one of the voice, the main sort of voice actor for Elmer Fudd, Arthur Q. Bryan. Arthur Q. Bryan does Clarence as Elmer Fudd. I mean, it's straight up Elmer Fudd. I don't know if he was, like, tanked. I don't know if someone dared him. And it's so bizarre, too, because the narration, the backstory, is carried by James Stewart. And I wonder what was going through his mind when he was doing this. He must have been like, this sucks.
Right.
What's going on here?
The first time the angel introduced himself as Quawent's odd body.
Right. There's no exaggeration here at all. He's clearly doing him as Elmer Fudd. And it is strange. It is trippy and strange, and having George Bailey fill in his own backstory, and then I was doing this, and Mr. Gower did this to me. It's almost this, like, the therapy version. And James Stewart, you sort of wonder the motivation. Why would you... I understand the first one. That was something that was done, and if they could get, like, a major star or two or three, all the better in remaking those films from mid-century on the radio. But there was really no need to do this, and it's not of a dramatic piece with the movie itself. It is a odd curio that... people in the sound of our voices are only going to be the ones who know about this. I guess it's a cool thing to know about. It's cool to know that they even did it once. But that James Stewart came back again in 1949 with Elmer Fudd sounds like I'm making it up, but it's out there.
It's out there, and you need to listen to it because you will be, yes, in that very exclusive club. And when you tell other people, they'll say, no, you're making that up. Nope, it's true. It happened, 1949. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's talk a little music right now, and a great live set from Oasis back in 1994. Man, did they sound great.
They did for a while, certainly. And I think this is one of their best, if not their very best, live session. It's called the Evening Session. It's from the end of 1994. So you've had the Definitely Maybe album, and Oasis were masters of the B-side, and really, like, your best bands, or your the bands that were, like, their best in a certain period, tended to be masters of the B-side. The Beatles had great B-sides, and The Who had excellent B-sides, and Stone Roses had fine B-sides. You can tell a lot about a band from their B-sides. So we're going to get, the fidelity is excellent, but we're going to get a song like It's Good to Be Free, which another band would have built an entire career around, an electric version of the Definitely Maybe closer, which was done acoustically, Married with Children, Talk Tonight, and Sad Song, and a fine version of Whatever, and this sort of tour de force effort on I Am the Walrus. Now, one of the things that's interesting about Oasis is that from 1994 through 96, they were one of the best bands we have ever had. And then after that, they were really not that good at all. So it's a short window. And part of that is the songs. And part of that is that for a while, Liam Gallagher was one of the finest singers in the history of rock and roll before he completely blew out his voice. And I think about singers like that. If you listen to, for instance, Guns N' Roses in 1987, Axl Rose could just sing the hell out of the joint, but the voice is going to be gone, certainly not that long after. They're going to make it work, but he had one of those voices where he was singing so well in a way because he was singing so incorrectly, and you're going to have that limited window when you sing like that.
Also, I wonder how much of it, too, is the fact that if you're a new recording group or just a solo artist, you've got this backlog of songs that you've been working on and refining your whole life until you get that break and you record, and maybe you've got enough to get you through a couple of albums, but then when you've got to come up with the new stuff and there's the pressure of touring and marketing, that whatever follows up isn't as good as what you had in the can before you first got to record.
Oh, definitely. And it doesn't always work out that way. For instance, like Radiohead, their first album, really, it's not of a piece with the bands. They found their way later on. They found their way as songwriters later on. But someone like the Strokes, pretty much everything they did of value is on their first two albums, where they had those songs. They had the great songs for the first album, and they had sort of these other ideas they were able to flesh out and carry through with the sophomore effort. Oasis had, Noel Gallagher had songs from Be Here Now, their third album, early on, and he just had this clutch of songs where they were derivative in a way sometimes, but nowhere near as much as people like to think. Later on, they became awfully derivative. But it's really like anything. A lot of times you'll see people, like writers, they'll have one story in them, if that, and then they're done. And so I'll see sometimes people who have everything handed to them, and if they could just produce something again, but they actually can't write anything else. It's just all over. I know it's all over for them. Remember that? It was a bad story, but it was in the New Yorker years ago. Cat Person was the name of it. It went viral. If you could write anything at all, you would have capitalized on that moment after that, but that was it, all done. So Oasis were a bit like that, but at least they were great for a while in the first place. And someone wanted to hear.
And musicians and writers, too, often they have that great moment, and then everything subsequent to that is just a variation on that theme.
Right, exactly. They're repeating themselves. And you had someone like the Kinks, and they did You Really Got Me, and you have the follow-up after that is quite similar with this big sort of proto-heavy metal riff. But then they're going to branch out and do something else, and Waterloo Sunset, and go in all these different directions. But I feel like when I do something, I don't even really like to talk about it that much more than just to document that I did it, because I always say to myself, it's like, well, you did that, that's over. How good are you now? Like, what's next? The next thing is always what matters most to me. I don't know like where I got that sort of mindset from, but it makes me almost, I feel like a loser when I'm not talking about the new thing or the next thing after that. I already know things that I'm going to be writing in 2025 now that are just when I'm going to get to them. If I wasn't that way, I wouldn't even be able to look in a mirror at myself. I'd be brushing my teeth like in the shower. So I don't know how a lot of people do it. And then they just talk about that thing that they did for the rest of their lives.
Let's listen to a little bit of music right now. This is from 1962 from the singer you best know from her big hit, The Locomotion. But this is a little tasty something from Little Eva.
We've been friends for...
You know, if you're a young singer, you could do worse than to be the babysitter for Jerry Goffin and Carole King. They wrote that song, and Jerry Goffin produced it in 1962.
She sings it so well. It has that sort of patty cake meets rhythm and blues introduction to it. And the tendency for a singer is to sing it faster than she does. She stays behind the beat, which speaks to her vocal prowess, and it's this song that it's catty, but in a good way. It's this directive. It has a note of menace to it in a kind of West Side Story sort of vibe, where don't mess with this person that I'm sort of claiming almost as romantic property. And it speaks to the difference too, I think, between envy and jealousy. It's a song really replete with that notion of jealousy. Envy is usually a feeling that we have towards someone who has something or more likely is able to do something we're not able to do. Jealousy is when something that we believe is ours or is connected to us is being compromised or poached upon by someone else. So this is definitely in that jealousy camp, but she's singing it with a wisdom beyond her years, and she really vocally rises to that occasion.
And we know how much the Beatles loved the R&B sounds, the girl group sounds of the early 60s, and so here's a wonderful version of that song the Beatles did live at the BBC in early 1963. Well, you can just hear the fun coming through, and you think to yourself how their world was going to change in the next 12 months after that.
Best rock and roll singer in history right there in John Lennon. Don't listen to Rolling Stone. They are steering you wrong. That is not just the best rock and roll singer in history. That is the classic, quintessential rock and roll Lennon-esque voice that is a product of 1963, especially... and then the first portion of 1964. But they begin it as this proto-hip-hop number, and you hear that pop, that drive in Ringo Starr's drums, how integral he was to their sound. He allowed them to do things that they would not have been able to do without him. He had only joined the band a few months before in August. They spend that crucial time together in their final Hamburg residency, but their only residency with Ringo Starr. You have those syncopated George Harrison. There's no like sort of solo that we heard there, but you get those syncopated guitar notes coming in and punctuating in between those Starr drums and the Lennon vocal and his command. He sings it faster than Little Eva sang it in 1962. Lennon he was your guy for jealousy songs, not envy songs, jealousy songs. He kind of had a bad streak to him with that in real life, but in his musical life, he was able to channel that into something fruitful. I would say that song, the cover, is, I don't know, one of my five or six, certainly top 10 favorite Beatles anything. It's a cover that I'll put up there with Twist and Shout. I think it's better even than Twist and Shout, which has, I don't know, maybe the best pure adrenalized vocal in rock and roll history. But it's everything to me. It's January 22nd, 1963. So it's Love Me Do has come out in October. And there they are just crushing it on the BBC. That is the Beatles at their essence.
That's great stuff. Finally, a production of The Monkey's Paw, the classic horror story, done in 1988 as a short film. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the production techniques. It felt like a video piece that was much older than just whatever that is, 34, 35 years ago. But I really enjoyed it.
It's the pace, I think, the stately pace, the funeral type pace. It's the close-ups. The camera is awfully claustrophobic. It doesn't really back away from these people. Like, we're sort of in everyone's face and in like an uncomfortable way. And watching this, I watched this over Christmas. It made me think that the guy who comes to visit and he brings the monkey's paw, he's a dick.
Yes.
He seems like he's okay. And the dad like looks up to him and let's be nice to this guy. I won his respect. But who, knowing that this can happen to you, who totes that around so casually? Like, he casually destroys the lives of these people. And that kind of, the story that on its face by W.W. Jacobs, it looks perfect. That's a flaw, though. You need the motivation in a story to kind of add up, and that doesn't really work. But the film is so underlit and it's dark, and I feel like it's the sort of the perfect thing to show to kids who are, I don't know, in eighth grade and mess them up in a way that you're allowed to do. And the mother's anguish when the kid comes back,
no,
the son comes back. And I think it's so effective as sort of a lesson. You know, like when you're watching a hockey game at night and they always say, like, you kids out there, I wonder, like, how many kids are sitting there who play youth hockey or going to take the tip from Andy Brickley. But for, like, you writers out there, you don't need to show the guy come back. It's enough that he's on the other side of the door knocking, and then the knock goes away, and he's not there. That's more effective than if you had this reveal where here's some special effects or whatever. Because it's messing with your mind and your imagination, and that's really where it gets a hold of you.
Oh, the best horror is always what you don't see. Although I have to say, that prop, whoever did that monkey paw, man, that thing was nasty.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because in every version of this, people are just sort of, like, non-committal that it's this like, severed part, shriveled, severed part. People willingly touch it. The woman is always like, oh, let me handle this. It's like, if someone presented you with that, wouldn't you be like, do I call the cop?
Right, get that out of my house.
It's a strange thing to sort of carry around in your jacket and sleeve. and what's weird about it, too, is the guy who brings the monkey paw over, he's like reluctant in a way, but it doesn't take a lot to convince him. Oh, yeah, okay, sure, I'll wreck your lives. And then he's off. Like, he's as solid and as emotionless, especially in this production. But really, it's that way in the actual story, too. As you can be, you almost feel like the humanity has been seared out of him by his own experience with the monkey paw. Because he says at one point, the dad's like, hey, did you do some wishes? He's like, yeah, I did some wishes. All right, I don't say about it.
Well, check it out from 1988, a version of The Monkey's Paw out there on YouTube, and quite good indeed. Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Colin, thank you much. Good luck out there on those mean streets of Boston. We'll check in again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.